top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm so glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. So much to talk about as the Super Bowl is just days away. That's the fun stuff. The other stuff is real serious, and we're going to give it to you all with perspective. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, is going to be with us. Britt Hume standing by, Fox's best in the business political analyst. He's going to have seen it all, and he could also put it in perspective. Right now, Tom Holman's giving a press conference, an update on the relationship between what law enforcement can do in the federal level and what they hopefully will begin to cooperate on a local level. It's been about a week since he took over, already making great progress. So before we get to Tom Holman and try to recap his remarks and Britt Hume, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They had a chance to do something a while ago, and it didn't work out, and we did Midnight Hammer. I don't think they want that happening again, but they would like to negotiate. We are negotiating with them right now.
I just don't know what we're negotiating about. We're at a breaking point. U.S. attacked twice by Iran, yet talks will continue despite narrowing down the scope. Now it's just nuclear. They were going to talk about them financing of Hezbollah, Hamas, and all their terrorist organizations. By the way, I think an attack is inevitable. It's been coming on since 1979. We got to finish the job, Mr. President.
Number two.
So take a look here. Favor voter ID to vote. You'll notice on all of it, it's all north of 75%. A photo ID to vote is not controversial in this country. It is not controversial by party, and it is not controversial by race.
There you go. That was Harry Enten on CNN talking about the popularity of voter ID. Seemingly both sides agree. America wants to know that their elections are legitimate. But there's dumb Democratic politicians who are pushing back against it, calling it Jim Crow 2.0. The name? Senator Chuck Schumer.
Number one.
The attacks on American citizens by masked hoodlums. If you were attacked by a masked person, you might think you were being kidnapped. You'd be justified in shooting the person to protect yourself.
Can you think of a more irresponsible statement? That's New York Congressman for at least a few more months, Jerry Nadler. You'd be justified shooting someone. The government funded for the next 2 weeks. The DHS, I guess, is going to be front and center as people try to reorganize. They are now talking about defunding the DHS in some circles, which to me is flat out insane, let alone ICE. Now, there's some reforms that are probably going to be put in place. Body cameras, I think there's no argument. Roving patrols, I think that Tom Holman is for leveling off on them. But when it comes to taking off masks, putting names on shirts, and having judicial warrants before you pursue an illegal immigrant, that's never going to fly. But where's it going to go? Britt Hume, welcome back.
Hello, Brian. Nice to talk to you.
Same here. So we can fund the government for another 2 weeks right now. What do you think is going to emerge as we try to work out some compromises on ICE and federal immigration enforcement?
Well, there'll be some adjustments in how ICE goes about these immigration arrests and deportations. Probably not very much. Broadly speaking, I think the public is on the administration's side, broadly speaking. But in terms of some of the methods that have led to deaths among people who, whatever they did, probably most people feel didn't deserve to die, there will be and have already been some changes in that. But this is a very interesting set of developments, Brian, because in a way, you look at the state of Minnesota and you think, this is upside-down land out there.
Yes.
I mean, people are coming to enforce the law. It is their duty and responsibility to do that under the law, and they're being told to get out of the state. I mean, I don't think since the civil rights era in the 60s, when these southern politicians were trying to block the enforcement of new civil rights laws, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that since that era. And that was a remarkable time.
So Tom Holman's out now, and he's talking about drawing down 700 agents immediately. But there's also some reports that Jackie Heinrich was saying that they have agreed to give him access to prisons. Britt, you know this, and I had to be reminded of it. That it was Barack Obama that set this up with Tom Holman and Jay Johnson to be able to go into prison and say, you got some illegal immigrants, we got pinged that you made an arrest. And they said, great, hold them for us. the controversy was sometimes they had to hold him past when they were serving for whether it was shoplifting or whatever infraction. And sometimes, so they said, we'll come in time. As soon as you arrest them, we'll come right away. So there's not going to be any extra detainment. So you have to wait for federal officials to show up. That was the controversy. But after Donald Trump got elected, said, I want to build the wall and kick out illegals, that's when Democrats started digging in on this. And now he's back and they're digging in more.
Well, I think that the point is that he was elected again and reawakened the Never Trump movement, and opposition to Donald Trump, as strong as you can make it, is the order of the day in the Democratic Party. It is what the Democratic Party base, broadly speaking, seems to want. And that is why you see these things happening under Donald Trump that didn't happen, when, even though they're the same thing, under other presidents. So that is really where we are. We are in a place where resist, resist, resist. It's the order of the day. And every Democratic politician recognizes that. And that is what they're doing.
I know. I mean, that's what's happening. You know what's interesting? You know, people are talking. We were talking about this on The Five yesterday. You know, we're back to woke. We thought woke was done with, and I don't think we are. You know, there's people now that are taking great pleasure in saying, let's defund ICE. And there's now they're going back to that chop zone from Seattle, blocking off certain blocks. They're running plates, civilians running plates to make sure that you're not an ICE agent going into neighborhoods or they won't let you in. I see that this is the same behavior, but it's not growing and being replicated and enforced by corporate America, by celebrities, by other left-wing activists. I see a difference here. Do you?
I think the politics have changed. And the only thing that, except that within the within interior drama of the Democratic Party, these things are thought to be popular and will get you approval within the base of the party. And of course, you know, when you're running for election in a seat that is, would otherwise be safe if you're a Democrat, you don't want to be caught out appearing to cooperate with Donald Trump or his law enforcement officers in any way.
It's just, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, we all have seen politicians that, you know, I know Democrats, Republicans would revel in pushing back against Barack Obama. I know that. And Bill Clinton, absolutely. And they turned on George Bush after initially going with him after 9/11. We watched that. But Britt, can you compare the pushback on those former presidents with the pushback on this current president?
I think it's unmistakably more intense with this president. It's the most intense resistance I've ever seen of any president. The ones you mentioned, and all the ones that came before. And partly that's because the country is legitimately deeply divided. Yeah. And we're in a situation where it's very hard to get compromise on major issues because they're so dug in, their bases are so intensely emotional about these issues, and these politicians are just simply doing what getting reelected requires them to do.
So, Britt, I just want you to hear how severe some of these left-wingers are. Listen what they're calling for. Here's Congresswoman Jayapal, cut six.
I mean, the whole DHS is a creation post 9/11 that should not exist. It is way too unwieldy. It's all these agencies put together. They should not be there. Right now, they're detaining 76,000 people every night in detention centers. And 95% of them have zero criminal record. So this is something I honestly never thought I would see in the United States of America.
See, he's totally wrong on that. 70% have either waiting for their charges to be pending, or they've been convicted of a crime already. I'm not sure about the 70, how many people are in detention, but there's a reason.
Hello.
Yeah, Britt, you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a reason. I'm sorry. There is a reason. The reason is, well, first and foremost, the reason is that these people came here illegally and in doing so committed a crime. It is a misdemeanor to be here illegally, but it is a crime. So for them to say there's no criminal record, what I guess they mean to say is that they have not committed any further crimes once they got here. And of course that's a piece of this, Brian, that has to be kept in mind, which is, you know, there's a large category of illegal immigrants who are here who have lived peacefully, worked hard, paid taxes, been good neighbors, and are very much liked in their communities. And to see them swept up in these immigration raids and hauled away, sometimes hauled away from their families or even with their families, can be a heartbreaking sight. And that is something the administration needs to deal with. It has been said by this administration over and over again that they're doing the worst first, and maybe they are. But as a matter of politics, people broadly favor the deportation of illegal immigrants. But when they see these pitiable sights of people that they know and have no fear of, and you know may even like very much, hauled away suddenly, that touches people's hearts.
So true. Let's go to Iran, Britt. I can almost see you doing stand-ups for ABC News talking about the hostage crisis. I can almost remember this has been a problem when Ronald Reagan and Oliver North signing Bibles to them, and they've been a problem. The Khobar Towers and what they've did to hurt our actions in and kill our people directly with EFPs and other things in Iraq. And now we have Iran, who took out our drone when Trump term one and rocketed Saudi Arabia that we didn't really react to, but we took out Soleimani. And then we had that operation that blew up and set back their nuclear program. And now I think we're heading towards a confrontation. Yesterday, a U.S. Carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, shot down a drone 500 miles away that was heading our direction. It would have been a Shahed 139, which is a one-way drone, which means it's there to blow something up. And then they tried to take a civilian tanker. It did refuse to be pulled over, and then the Navy came to rescue it. This doesn't seem like a country afraid to confront us or convince we will. Where do you think this is heading?
Well, in my view, is it's probably heading for military action by the United States, simply because the president has kind of gotten out on a limb on this. The warnings he gave to Iran before this massacre of civilian protesters, the things he said, that help is on the way to the protesters, and then the massacres occurred, and he didn't do anything, at least not yet. And then that's been thought about this huge buildup of military assets in the region, such that massive destruction could be visited on Iran, and Iran's trying to get out of it by saying, well, we'll negotiate with you about our nuclear program. A new nuclear deal is not going to help the people of Iran very much. All it will do is forestall U.S. military action. So I don't think it's going to work for the Iranians. I don't think there'll be a deal available. I don't think they've shown any signs anyway that they're willing to accede to the administration's demands. So that leaves the president where he kind of has to act, or he's going to look weak in the deterrence of other enemies that he may have created by the actions in Iran earlier, and particularly by the recent capture of Maduro, would be lost if he backed away on Iran. So I think he'll have to do it.
And so, Britt Hume, there's also the chaos of how these talks were supposed to take place, trilateral talks, on the urgency of Turkey. It was going to be Jared Kushner representing us along with Witkoff. All right. And then out of nowhere, Iran says, we're going to change who's representing us, we're going to change locations and formats. We're only talking about one thing, and that's the nuclear program. We're not talking about financing of proxy groups or anything else. Really? So I guess we're going to pursue it. But like you said, if we walk out with a nuclear deal that no one believes that they're going to fulfill, that to me is not something we should even be thinking of. I sense, just judging by President Trump's pattern, they were buying more time to get THAAD missiles, Patriot missiles, and maybe more intelligence in place to see what type of attack we actually want to do.
Yeah, and it's a challenge to figure out an attack that would not completely destroy the country, but would take down the regime. You know, we've done some remarkable things lately militarily. But this is a significant challenge. But I think in the end, it's going to happen.
You know, why do you think, Britt, that we have about five Gulf states, Arab nations, that are rivals, if not enemies, with Iran, urging us not to act? Are we to believe they mean this, or is that for public consumption? What do you think?
I think they generally are worried about a retaliation in the region from Iran. And Iran can't really do much to the United States for all of its bluster, but it can hit targets in that region, our allies and friends. And they're worried that when the retaliation comes for any U.S. military action, it will be against them because they can't hit the U.S. So I think their worry is real, which is why I think, as you point out, these anti-missile systems are something we're trying to put in place over there.
All right, well, we'll see how this goes. Brit Hume, thanks so much. Always great. Exciting times.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. God bless you, buddy.
Yeah, back at you. And Brit knows it. He knows this is the country taking shots at us for 40 years. 40 years. I mean, back in the day when there was just 6 and 11 o'clock news and nobody, you know, no one was watching CNN unless it was a war. This would be the lead story almost every day. That and then Saddam Hussein and his nuclear weapons and trying to fool the inspectors. And then you just say, well, how long does this go on? This is a president that says no longer. No longer Venezuela, Cuba, you're on the clock. And we're not going to take it. We're not going to take this anymore when it comes to Iran. I don't think there's any way the president's not acting within 2 weeks. Tom Holman still giving his presser. Don't move.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
This podcast is brought to you by Carvana. Selling your car shouldn't feel like a second job. It should feel easy. With Carvana, it is. Just visit Carvana.com, enter your license plate or VIN, answer a few quick questions, and get an offer in minutes. Like what you see? We'll pick it up right from your door and hand you your check. No haggling, no hassle, no problem. Car selling made easy on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Given this increase, as far as what I saw yesterday with the roadblocks being set up, you're not going to stop ICE. You're not going to stop Border Patrol. The only thing you're doing is irritating your community and want to go get groceries or pick the children up or whatever. I talked to the chief of police, and he committed to taking swift action on those illegal roadblocks. They're illegal. We shouldn't tolerate them. Again, a complete drawdown is going to depend on cooperation, continued cooperation of local and state law enforcement.
So, by the way, that is Tom Holman. His press conference still active right now. He has one of his things he said, yeah, we noticed that they're doing. Certain neighborhoods are taking it upon themselves to screen out who gets in and out. Do you believe this? Setting up their own roadblocks. And one thing he just said, you're not going to stop ICE or you're going to stop Border Patrol because you're going to set up and decide if an SUV is going to pass through here. No, you're all going to be arrested. And your cars are going to be destroyed if they're blocking it. And you're not going to be, I think it's illegal to run plates on people unless you're a law enforcement person. You're running plates to find out if this is a law enforcement person in that black SUV? Really? Meanwhile, Tom Holman made it clear he's going to take down. He says, I like the progress we're making. Well, I'm going to take out 700 ICE officers. Okay, 700 agents going to go. They're going to go elsewhere. They're going to go to Maine. They're going to go to other places. They're going to go to West Virginia. 650 arrests last weekend. These are all illegal immigrant criminals. Some of the 9 million minimum that got here, let alone the gotaways, are like 2.5 million. Those are people that are so determined to get here and probably doing something illegal that they didn't even want to go across the border, even though they could only have to do is say, I feel under threat in El Salvador, and you get to stay. No remain in Mexico. You come, you show, you got in. And still they're saying, I want to sneak in. Those are the people that Tom Holman's arresting. And he's going to be more focused under Tom Holman than Kristi Noem was on people who have violated the law as opposed to just came here illegally. Not saying that they're not eventually going to go. But the roving patrols that they've been accused of, if they did exist, I'm not sure they did, they're not happening now. But 700 agents coming out, and they say they're getting cooperations with local law enforcement, which is a big, big change, and that's great. Rich Lowry next.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
That makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Given this increase in unprecedented collaboration, and as a result of the need for less law enforcement officers to do this work in a safer environment, I have announced effective immediately we will draw down 700 people effective today. 700 law enforcement personnel.
All right, those long pauses make me want to pause to make sure he's not going to keep speaking. But a very composed, calm Tom Homan, very pleased. He's the border czar, and he was brought into Minneapolis to quiet things down, settle things down. And it looks as though they have allowed access to for federal agents, Border Patrol, ICE, FBI, to work in the jail system, get access to those who are being detained who are here illegally that have committed crimes. That's the way it's always been. They weren't doing that, and now they are. He credited the mayor and governor and sheriffs, local sheriffs, for now cooperating in a very positive way. So they've left 2,000. They're taking down 700. And people can go in there sub-zero weather, and they can set up their own barriers. But I've Tom Homan said, we're just going to take them down. It's not going to stop us. But if you continue to do it, we're never going to leave, essentially. Rich Lowry joins us now, editor of National Review. Rich, pretty, that's a lot of newsworthy. That's a newsworthy press conference.
Yes, I think, Brian, he was sent there to declare victory and go home, or declare victory and ease up. And hopefully there's actually some victory. So if he's right that he's getting more cooperation from city and county jails, that's great. And if they've knocked off a lot of people from the targets, which target list, which I assume they have, they've been there for a while now in force. And you can draw down, great. And but clearly, Trump did not want a confrontational approach anymore. And Homan has been there to try to calm the waters. And if you can get some progress as well, that's all to the good.
Well, we know too. We got 2 weeks to work out some type of reforms. They say with enforcement, with DHS, with the immigration arm. Well, what does Chuck Schumer want? He wants the masks off. He wants the names on every single officer. He wants people to be able to see it. Number two, three, he wants body cameras. That's already done. Number four, he says, I want an end of roving patrols and judicial warrants for any person who's going to be arrested. The warrants, to me, is a non-starter. What do you think?
Total non-starter. I think everything is a non-starter, basically, except for me, for the body cameras, which they're going to do anyway and will vindicate ICE overwhelmingly, the same way they have the cops. And if they don't overwhelm ICE, vindicate ICE, we want to know, right? Everyone, there's a public interest in knowing. So body cameras all for them. Identification, yes. I don't think these guys always are very careful about making sure their numbers can be seen and people can take pictures of them and whatever. But names, no. Unmasking, no. End of roving patrols, no. And the judicial warrants for administrative warrants would basically kneecap interior enforcement. So that's a hard no. So I don't know whether there's going to be, how much of a deal there's going to be here. We just, Democrats now kind of have Republicans a little bit over a barrel because they really don't want to fund DHS, right? Whereas Republicans do. Now, there are other things involved like TSA, and that'll be a pain point the way it was in the first during the first shutdown. But I think most of these demands are we just can't give in.
No, I hear you. So Senator Lindsey Graham in the Oval Office yesterday made it clear on the search warrants he agrees with you. Cut three.
No, makes no sense. If we have to get a search warrant to get 15 million people out, Schumer's telling me he doesn't want them out. It's the most ridiculous idea. They do have some good ideas, I think. But I've got a better idea. It's your idea. In sanctuary cities. On immigration, I know what I'm talking about. I've got the scars to prove it. They're playing, y'all are playing like Biden didn't exist. Y'all won't tell the American people about Lake and Riley. It's a one-sided debate.
So, and he was obviously emotional, and he gets ticked off when people pretend as if the president's walking around scooping up children, American children, who just want to go to first grade. And I actually heard Senator Chris Murphy say that they're tear gassing kids in school.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think that one, the source of that one, a tear gas canister was leased like somewhere near a school,
right.
When there was some unrest. So almost all of that is just myth and urban legend. and lies. And on the administrative warrants, this is the way ICE has operated for decades. And if it's a warrant for removal, by the way, there's always been an enormous judicial process to get that final order of removal that you're going to enforce. And I don't think there's a case for any illegal immigrants staying here. There's certainly not a case for anyone who's gone through the entirety of the process. All their claims have been denied, and a judge has said, go home, and you haven't gone home. In that instance, obviously, we should go pick you up and send you home.
I thought so. Fascinating debate on voter ID. You know, I keep seeing these polls. It's never been the number one talking point. So I always thought to myself, this is kind of interesting. Voter ID. It doesn't seem like minorities, you know, they're not taking it like Chuck Schumer. They're not saying we want voter ID to make sure you don't vote. We just want to make sure you are who you say you are. And people say, well, that's because minorities, working class, don't really have ID. Everybody's got ID. And I said to myself, this is an argument. I never thought it was a priority. I always say, you know, when the election comes up, I go, wouldn't it be great if everybody just mandated voter ID? Well, that's what they want to do with the SAVE Act, and that's what they're trying to get passed in the House. And I thought this was really interesting to turn up on CNN. There's this guy, Howard Enten, who does all the poll stuff. He's very flamboyant. And he said this about where the country is on voter ID, cut 14.
What are we talking about here? So take a look here. Favor voter ID to vote. Look, I got all this polling on the screen going back since 2018. You'll notice on all of it, it's all north of 75%, 76%, 76%, 76%, 81%, and then 83% in the last year of Americans agree with Nicki Minaj. They favor photo ID to be able to vote. But even 71% of Democrats favor photo ID to vote. 85% of white people favor it. 82% of Latino. 76% of black Americans favor it. So the bottom line is this. Voter ID is not controversial in this country. A photo ID to vote is not controversial in this country. It is not controversial by party, and it is not controversial by race. The vast majority of Americans agree with Nicki Minaj.
So that those numbers are, it's not 47%. This is overwhelming. So Chuck Schumer came out, and I can play it for you. He says it's Jim Crow 2.0. Come on.
That's what their voice said. And look, if someone doesn't have a photo ID, you know what we need to do? Get that person a photo ID, because they can't participate in American life fully. Leave aside voting. There's so many others. They can't go into an office building in Manhattan, right?
No.
They can't board a plane.
They can't work for Uber Eats.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing. So everyone has photo ID, and there's no evidence anywhere where we have voter ID, which is most states in the union, that it's suppressed voting. It's just completely made up, and they just, one, believe that in the convenience theory of voting, like if it takes you 2 seconds to bring out a photo ID, that's going to discourage you from voting, and it's just not. And they just believe everything Republicans propose is Jim Crow 2.0.
So when we look right now at where you're at politically, it looks like Republicans have outraised Democrats. But for the most part, in the generic ballot, Democrats have a 6-point advantage almost every poll. And you saw what happened in Texas in that state race. I know there's some things that are just a one-off, but other things, there's got Republicans worried about Texas and the Senate race. Do you think Republicans have a right to be worried about the Senate race in Texas?
I think if everything breaks exactly the wrong way for Republicans, if it's a Democratic wave, I'm not sure it's going to be a wave. I think they're certainly going to win the House. But if there's a Democratic wave and, you know, a poisonous runoff on top of the poisonous primary we've seen so far on the Republican side, Ken Paxton rather than John Cornyn, who's the incumbent and quite entrenched, and Jasmine Crockett, you know, performs better than you might expect, then it could get close. It's hard to see that Democrats would actually win that seat. That is, you know, a five-alarm fire around the country if that happens. But it could be close, you know, could be a race Republicans have to spend a lot of money on, which they don't want to do.
So let me bring you to the next phase. There's John Cornyn says he's going to call the president today, and he hasn't talked to him in a while. They don't have a problem. He doesn't have a problem with John Cornyn. He's friends with Ken Paxton and Wesley Hunt. Mm-hmm. I think he's a superstar. I'm not sure this is the right time to run for Senate. But does the president want to get the guy that's polling the best against both Democrats and just endorse Senator Cornyn like he had to alienate Scott Brown and go for John Sununu in New Hampshire, even though he's friends with Scott Brown?
He occasionally makes these really practical choices where it's not where his heart would go, it's where his head is, and I think that's the case Cornyn has to make. I would say the odds are against him succeeding. but he should try. Trump's endorsement matters a lot in these
Wait a second. You don't think that Senator Cornyn will succeed in a win, or you don't think he'll succeed in getting his endorsement?
And getting Trump's endorsement.
Interesting. I think if his pollster tells him that Cornyn gives him the best chance, I think he would do it. I think he's would have worried about that. I was struck by this on the left. James Carville weighed in on who he thinks has got the advantage of in 2028. Listen to this, cut 23.
If I were like betting the Kentucky Derby and I saw this 12-1 horse and I said, yeah, I want to get a price, I'd take J.B. Pritzker.
Really? Why?
Well,
not Kamala Harris? She's black.
She has no chance.
Why not?
Because no Democrat wants anything to do with anybody that had anything to do with 2024. Just win. They don't. If we nominate two white males, no one's going to give a
He says Governor Pritzker spends all his time in South Carolina in black churches. I mean, to me, I want to hear what you have to say, Rich. What do you think?
Well, one, what you're saying is not that necessarily he's a favorite, right? It's just that he's a good medium shot bet if you're looking for that kind of money. And you might be right about that. I can see how people like Gavin Newsom. I don't like him. I don't see how what the appeal of J.B. Pritzker is at all. I just don't get it. Now, James Carville knows much more about Democratic politics than I am, but I'm skeptical of that one. Well, he's absolutely right, of course, is Kamala Harris, who's leading in a lot of the polls, not having a chance. I think that's name ID, and no one's going to want to go down that road again.
Yeah, I just think that Gavin Newsom got really called out. I think it was Vanity Fair when they just said Gavin Newsom's got problems. And they spelled out all that he's done on homeless, the train to nowhere, the fact that his state is losing more people than gaining for the first time in generations. And he talked about what's going on with the budget deficit that they had, what's going on with energy. There's like 12 things that have gone south since he took the job. And that's where if I'm Ro Khanna, if I'm Pritzker, if I'm Mayor Pete, if I'm Governor Shapiro, he doesn't get out of the primary.
Yeah, you might be right. It's just difficult for those guys to make that kind of case against California, because California is their model of governance. See, he hasn't done anything that those guys also don't support. It's just he's actually had authority in a major state and helped ruin it because of those policies. So, yeah, I think in a general, his record be an enormous millstone around his neck. I'm not quite sure in the primary.
Interesting. I thought, you know, if I'm going against him, I'm running it like I'm a Republican. I mean, because what you say is what you've done is giving illegal immigrants health care. Do you think Democrats are still proud of that?
I do. I think standing on a debate stage, when they're asked to raise their hands, they'll all raise their hands again the way they always do. I think they've kind of learned nothing. At least they'll admit publicly. They won't admit publicly that they've learned anything, whether it's trans or the border.
Lastly, just real quick on Iran, I think it's inevitable we're going to hit them. And I hope, and we're thinking it through, because you got to be smart, especially in the Middle East. But there's no way I want to do a nuclear deal with Iran.
Oh, yeah. Now, what his ask is, of course, is much bigger than nuclear, right? It's missiles and give up your proxies, basically.
But they've narrowed down the scope. That's not on the table.
Oh, they have? Okay.
Yeah.
No, it's just nuke. Yeah, I don't trust them. You know, I don't trust any nuclear deal. If I'm the Iranians, though, I string this along. I make as many concessions that I can pull back. You know, hopefully J.B. Pritzker is president in 29 if you're Iran, rather than J.D. Vance or another Republican, and just play for time. So we'll see.
I don't think J.D. Vance is reluctant to do anything, and that's fine. I think Trump's the guy. And do I think we're going to wait 2.5, three more years? No way. This has been a problem, Rich, my entire adult life.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, 1979, they've been killing our people.
Yeah, this is the most anti-American regime on Earth. It's part of it. The reason it exists is part of its founding myth is we're the great Satan. So the way Trump has focused on this and gotten them on their back heels is extraordinary.
I love to see it. And I also love that Argentina is kicking out China and China's go, OK, we'll switch to Uruguay. Good luck with Uruguay. Mm-hmm. So we got Venezuela back, Colombia back. It looks like Argentina back, Panama. We kicked them out of the canal. And by the way, I think that Cuba, I do agree with the president, within a year, they got to go. We pressured Mexico to let them wither. Just bring humanitarian aid, no more oil. So there's a lot of stuff going on, Rich. These are persistent problems we always debate, you write about. The president's addressing all of them, even if it's not appreciated in the polls.
Yep, totally. Rich Lowry. The ambition's been amazing.
And read about it in the National Review. Rich Lowry, thank you. Back in a moment.
Thanks, Frank.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. News, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
If it comes down to me taking out myself and my kids versus us being taken and harmed by ICE, like, God help me, I did not want to do it. This is not the life I wanted. But that is a very dark thought that I've had. Death would be a easier out than for my children to be taken and harmed by these pedophiles.
This is the type of insanity that this is what we're getting out of Minneapolis and probably some other pockets in other major cities. They actually want America to believe that mass ICE agents are grabbing women and children and sending them out of the country. It's illegal immigrant criminals. Worse first, people have overstayed their visa, snuck in illegally, phony asylum claims, things that have not held up. They're the ones being targeted. Once in a while, out of the 9 million that are here illegally, there might be somebody here with papers at work that could get caught up in the system. But no one's grabbing children. Last time, I'll just tell you, the 5-year-old has a father. The father here illegally didn't show up for his court case, according to reports. They went to grab him. He ran, leaving the kid by himself. They knocked on the door to bring the 5-year-old to the woman inside. She refused to open the door, wouldn't take him. Neighbors said, we'll take him. But they're not allowed to just go hand kids off to neighbors. Even if that really is a neighbor and that's really a place that you should be, you're not allowed. Do you think about that? You're an agent. You go into a neighborhood you know nothing about to get an illegal immigrant. You're looking at, you don't know if the person's dangerous or not. So you go to grab them. They leave. They run. You chase them down. The kid's left. And then a woman walks up to you and says, I'll take the kid. I'm pretty sure to give that kid up is one of the stupidest things you can do as a human, let alone as an officer. So now they're saying children are afraid. Why are they afraid? Because of you. And by the way, if you want kids that were scared, the whole Don Lemon choreographed videoed raid, they were going up to children screaming in their faces. First, they went across the street where the daycare was, saying their parents are Nazis. We don't care about those kids. In fact, Don Lemon's reporting says sometimes protests are uncomfortable. Really? Okay. Sometimes when your dad's here illegally and committed a crime, it leaves the children uncomfortable. That's what happens. I'm sure that a lot of people are in prison right now were arrested in front of their families, sadly.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, around the country, around the world, where we're still trying to understand how to shovel. Because even though it snowed 2 weeks ago, snow is still absolutely everywhere. Big story in the New York Post today, how the mayor was so concerned before his press conference on getting the right overcoat. He had to make sure it wasn't too ostentatious, but yet look good and look personal. Imagine, according to one Democratic insider, imagine if he put that much time into actually getting snow off the street and garbage picked up as he does in how he looks and cutting TikTok tapes. That's what we elected. Not me. I'm not only pay taxes here. I don't get to vote here. This hour, we're going to be joined by the governor of Montana, Greg Gianforte. He's going to be with us. Sean Alexander, former NFL MVP, longtime Seattle Seahawk running back. He's going to be with us. Former Alabama running back, too. And then Todd Heap and Dennis Pitta are going to be with us from former Ravens, who obviously are going to weigh in on the Super Bowl, but also about John Harbaugh, their former coach, and what he probably is capable of doing in New York. And also, the fact is, the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, longtime coach over in Baltimore. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They had a chance to do something a while ago and it didn't work out, and we did Midnight Hammer. I don't think they want that happening again, but they would like to negotiate. We are negotiating with them right now. Yes.
I don't know why we're negotiating with Iran, because the U.S. was attacked twice yesterday, a merchant vessel, and then a drone was heading towards the USS Abraham Lincoln. That doesn't seem like a country that wants to have peace or give peace a chance. And what are we talking about their nuclear program for? You know they can't be trusted.
Number two.
So take a look here. Favor voter ID to vote. You'll notice on all of it, it's all north of 75%. A photo ID to vote is not controversial in this country. It is not controversial by party, and it is not controversial by race.
And what's so significant about that? It came from CNN. A voter ID is stunningly popular with all Americans, Republicans and Democrats. But still, Chuck Schumer says it's Jim Crow 2.0.
Number one.
The attacks on American citizens by masked hoodlums. If you were attacked by a masked person, you might think you were being kidnapped. You'd be justified in shooting the person to protect yourself.
Jerry Nadler, what a despicable human being. The government funded for at least two more weeks. DHS now has to figure out a way. They're going to welcome in some reforms, perhaps. But DHS, some people are actually talking about breaking up and defunding the entire department. TSA, FEMA, all of it. Craziness. In Washington, D.C. It is not like that in Montana. Governor Greg Gianforte joins us now. Governor, welcome back.
Brian, it's good to be with you.
Hey, Governor, first off, when you look in Washington, what are you thinking now? How different is that from Montana in terms of the mindset?
Well, you know, I spent 3.5 years in Washington as part of the U.S. Congress, and geez, nothing there happens without a crisis. We have common sense in Montana. We watch the dumpster fire that's going on in Minnesota. Here in Montana, I was proud to sign into law, we outlawed sanctuary cities. We're going to work with the federal administration to make sure our communities are safe. We have a few communities that are kind of making more liberal noises, but working with our AG, we're going to back law enforcement. We're going to enforce the law here and make sure our communities are safe.
And for people that don't know, a press conference just finished up with Tom Homan made this announcement about a drawdown.
Given this increase in unprecedented collaboration, and as a result of the need for less law enforcement officers to do this work in a safer environment, I have announced effective immediately we will draw down 700 people effective today. But 700 law enforcement personnel.
So they are, Governor, going to do that, but there's still going to be just about 2,000 in these cities. And they're blocking off certain blocks and deciding if ICE can enter certain blocks. Have you ever seen such anarchy outside Seattle?
Well, there is such a difference between blue states and red states, and it's becoming more apparent all the time. I mean, in red states, you're seeing lower taxes, less regulation, and we back law enforcement because the number one role of government is to ensure a safe community. The dereliction of duty of Governor Walz, Mayor Fry, is just reprehensible, and the pain and suffering it's causing for the people of Minnesota. And I'll tell you, the rank and file citizens are sick and tired of it, and they're leaving in droves.
I know. It's amazing the big push to red states like yours in Montana. I mean, we have Texas, we have Florida, especially North Carolina, South Carolina. People are leaving New York. New York's losing two more congressional seats. I think California's going to lose four. I mean, people are voting with their feet. Do you sense that these are Democrats who ruined those states and want to ruin more? Or do you think it's Republicans says, I can't be hostage to these policies?
Well, I've been very clear that Montana is a sanctuary for freedom and free enterprise. And the people that are moving here embrace those ideals. We have some of the lowest unemployment in the country. People that want a job can get a job. We've paid off all our debt here in Montana. We're completely debt-free. And we're one of only two states in the country where wage growth has exceeded inflation over the last 5 years. What that means is the American dream is still alive in Montana. And people are moving here because they want the opportunity to pursue it.
You're also working with Turning Point USA, and you're trying to push to the high schools in New York. I don't know if you heard, but St. John's, everyone's focused on their basketball team, but they went out of their way to say Turning Point not welcome on campus again. Are you getting any of that pushback when in your universities?
Well, we have a Turning Point chapter on virtually every campus in Montana, and we're going to have Erica Kirk here in the Capitol later today to promote their Club America program. This is such an important program. It's a high school program, and what we've seen is a huge uptick in the number of these Club America chapters in Montana. This is a civic engagement club. These are young people that love the Lord, love America, and want to learn more about our system of government. I had a chance to meet with a bunch of students from Bozeman and Livingston, Montana, just last week, and the dialogue was refreshing. These people love America. So later today, we're going to be promoting this. We have these Club America chapters now in 10% of all the high schools in Montana. We want it to be 100% because we want to teach our young people about American exceptionalism, about faith, and about this system of government we have that's so dear. And I think the uptick we've seen in Montana in this 250th year anniversary of our country bodes very well for the next 250 years.
So what if a group went up and said, hey, I'm a socialist. I want to push a DSA program among high school students. How would you handle that, Governor?
Well, people have the freedom of speech. But I know that there's no system that has lifted more people out of poverty and given dignity to individuals better than the system we have here in this country. And they need to hear that. And that story has been squeezed out of our high schools. It's been squeezed off of campuses. Turning Point is doing a phenomenal job. My wife and I first got to know Charlie when he was 18. We've been supporters of him for a long time. We're thrilled to have Erica Kirk and her team here later today. We want to get these Club America chapters into every single high school in the state so the young people can embrace and learn to love America and support it as good citizens.
Right. And lastly, Governor, as you're a Republican, are you worried about the midterms holding the House and Senate?
Well, I'm chairman of the Republican Governors Association. In addition to at the federal level, we have 36 governors races this year. I think the contrast we're seeing between red states and blue states is pretty visible to people. Nobody at this point, even Minnesotans, don't want to be in Minnesota. I think people are going to vote for common sense. They're going to vote their pocketbook, and they're going to vote for public safety.
Yeah, and it's all going to be decided in the next 9 months. Governor Greg Gianforte, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. When we come back, we talk a little Super Bowl. Sean Alexander is there. He's over in San Francisco, but he played for Seattle. He's in the 2005 NFL MVP. A five times, he went over 1,000 yards, got very close to 2,000 one year. The former Alabama running back will be joining us talking about this latest incarnation of the Seattle juggernaut. And at the bottom of the hour, we talk about the Super Bowl with former Super Bowl players Todd Heap and Dennis Pitta of the Ravens. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
About 6:15 Eastern time, 3:15 local time. They're going to play the Super Bowl 60, and it's going to be, I think it's going to be a great game. Seattle taking on the New England Patriots. Absolutely nobody thought New England Patriots were going to go from worst to division winners, let alone representing the AFC back in the Super Bowl. And they did it with the 23-year-old quarterback, Drake May, who won, I think, 4 or 6 games a year before, but showed so much promise, people thought they got their guy. And they do, no doubt about it. Very impressive. And now they've dropped in town on Sunday night, both teams. They're practicing, trying to make it like it's at every other game. People are talking about what's going to be happening at halftime. People are talking about what's going to be happening. Is it going to be politically driven? But most of all, they're just going to be playing football. And I think Seattle, yeah, they've been here before, but the last time they were there was New England Patriots, who walked away with a victory. Not many people thought they would. Remember, going in for the winning score on the one-yard line with the best running back in the NFL in the backfield, Marshawn Lynch, almost impossible to tackle. Tackle and contain. They passed the ball and it was intercepted. New England holds on for the victory. It was stunning. And that's the last time Seattle was in the Super Bowl. And it was really the end of their dynasty. They had won the Super Bowl the year before and that was it. And New England would go back and not only win that one, they'd come back and have that monster comeback against the Atlanta Falcons. And for Tom Brady, he'd win again in the pandemic year. With Tampa Bay, and he did it at home, but nobody was in the stands, which is absolutely bizarre. But everything was bizarre about those days. So we're about to talk to Sean Alexander, the 2005 NFL MVP, the legendary Seattle Seahawk running back. He's going to be joining us shortly, but I want you to hear Mike McDonald yesterday. So this is interesting. Mike McDonald is the head coach of the Seahawks. He's playing the Super Bowl. Here's who he gives credit to, the guy that took a chance at him kind of coming out of college as a coach, cut 28.
I don't think it's possible to overstate his influence on me. I love John Harbaugh. He's a one of my biggest mentors. Was willing to take chances on me when other people weren't, and invested in me and my career throughout and stretched, you know, like the things that I felt like I could do. He had a vision for me in my career that I probably didn't have for myself. And all those principles that are part of his program that he's about as a person resonated with me. And those are a lot of the foundational principles that we brought to Seattle. And he's a great friend. He's got a great family. So I can't tell you how much I love him.
There you go. That is Mike McDonald. And you look at the coaches tree. The Rams put a lot of coaches around the NFL and now become head coaches. And so does John Harbaugh, the Ravens. And that's what you looked at. He was a special teams coach when he got hired for the Ravens. They took a big chance on him with a famous name. His brother, an outstanding quarterback. His dad, a longtime coach in football circles. The name was known. But not so much John, more Jim. And now John, after 18 seasons, I think is the highest paid coach in the NFL. He's going to sign something like a 5-year, $20 million a year contract. So let's go out to a guy that's pulling for the Seahawks. How do I know? Because he spent the majority of his career there and still talking about him today. And he had 5 1,000-plus seasons, including one where he almost had 2,000 yards rushing. Sean Alexander, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What up, brother? How you doing?
Sean, don't tell me when the year started you thought your Seahawks are getting to the Super Bowl. I better quickly get a hotel in San Francisco. There's no way, right?
Nah, it doesn't really work like that, no matter how good your team is. But they played the Commanders, in the back end of the season. That's the game where Jaden Daniels hurt his shoulder. Seahawks was just really, had the game pulled away. And I went down to the locker room with my sons and I was talking to, Coach Mack and I saw the equipment guys and some of the trainers that were there when I was there. And first I thought, gosh, y'all look old. Okay. But anyway, we got to talking. They said, you know what? We have felt this way two times before, your 05 team and that Super Bowl team. And I was like, oh, okay, here. So we got some here. And they said, yeah, we just know we do. And, we're flying under radar with 8-2, flying under the radar. And I said, oh, that's the best way. That's kind of how my team was. I want to say we were 15-2 maybe 14-2. And no one just saw us coming, but we knew we had that kind of a team. But when you don't see it, it kind of surprised everybody except the people that are in the water. You know what I mean? And so they were excited. So I began to watch them like that. And, they handled business. And those last few games of the year, the big battle with both the Niners and the Rams, kind of solidified what they thought was going to happen.
Yeah, it's not like they slid through, didn't play teams or banged up teams. They played really good teams, and they prevailed. Sean, what's amazing is, too, you have a coach in Mike McDonald who kind of work his way up through the system, but he was unproven. And you have a quarterback that started showing steady improvement after I watched him in New York. I saw him got drafted. He was at Fox News the day after, and great to see him and his family. And they thought he was going to be a quarterback for the next 15 years with the New York Jets. And it obviously didn't work. They sent him to Carolina. Couldn't hold on to the job there. Learned a lot, seemingly, in San Francisco, backing up as a backup there. And then he merges better in Minnesota. And then he's seen, and Minnesota goes, you know, we're better off with this rookie. And then Seattle says, we'll pay you to come there. So this is an interesting arc, isn't it? It almost is like Jim Plunkett-esque. Remember, he ended up as a Super Bowl quarterback, but he looked like a bust in New England.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because, you know, this is what you love about sports. You get to see the rise of people, the perseverance. These are the great stories that you get to see, love, and, you know, get to watch all the way through. And so he's just battle tested. You know, you got to have strong mentals to be able to go from top pick, not getting it done in New York, go to another team, still not what they want. Go to another team, you're the backup to all the way around. So, you know, we're really just proud of Sam. You know, as a player, as a person, just the ability to continue to mature and grow, and you know, and in these last few games, he has really showed up big and done his job at a high level.
Sean, you are partnering with Stand Together to tackle root causes in education and community development. What could you tell us?
Man, Stand Together is probably about 900 of some of the most successful businessmen, women, philanthropic leaders in the country. You know, and their goal was, what can we do? How can we put our talents, whether it's time or treasure or unique ideas that made us successful in the business room, and give that to the community? And then they grabbed about 300 of some of the top community foundations or projects, and they just meshed it together. I get to be the ambassador. I get to play the role of building the perfect tripod, the ones who are doing the great work, funding the great work, and now me, the influencers, to bring attention to it. And it's amazing. We just believe in people. We want to see people strive and do great.
And, of course, you're a great ambassador with a million-dollar smile and great athletic ability. Sean Alexander, thanks so much. It's called Stand Together. Sean, best luck to your Seahawks on Sunday.
Go Hawks. MLB.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I could not be more proud of anyone, quite honestly, for what Sam has endured, his perseverance, his resilience, and the way that he's continued to battle. I mean, a lesser person could have given up a while ago, and yet he has been unaffected. I mean, it's one thing to say, yeah, well, this is his living and this is what you do, but when you talk with him and he's interviewed, and everything I've watched, in fact, I just saw an interview with him just before coming on the air with you today. I'm just amazed at how optimistic and upbeat he's been. He's not jaded by the process, and he's been through a lot. And I bet that he would tell you that having gone through what he went through in New York and in Carolina, it really helped get him to where he is now.
And then it's Troy Aikman, of course, who had 10 years in the NFL and multiple Super Bowls, talking about Sam Darnold, who had a much different path. He was supposed to be just as good as Aikman, wasn't with the Jets, and it has a lot to do with the Jets. There was not much talent around him. That's how they got the high draft pick, number 2 overall. And then they go to Carolina, where he could have a fresh start. It didn't work out. I don't know how much talent they had. I didn't track it close, but I know he could not hold on to the job. And in San Francisco, when asked, he stepped up and looked good. In Minnesota, he looked great, but fell apart late of the season and then did not have a good playoff. So the Vikings moved on. Seattle was fortunate to get him. And when they got him, they're now finding themselves in the Super Bowl, taking on a 23-year-old quarterback in the New England Patriots, another unlikely finalist to be the world champion. With us right now to discuss this and more is Todd Heap and Dennis Pitta, both Ravens legends who starred for that team and that organization, who doesn't ever seem to have a bad year. Guys, welcome.
Good to be on with you, Brian.
Hey, first
thanks
off,
for having us, Brian.
Hey, listen, I know you don't have necessarily a horse in this race, and I do want to talk to you about John Harbaugh, who's now a few miles away from us, but you must love the Sam Darnold career arc, would you say? You want to start, Dennis?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, interestingly enough, I coach at San Clemente High School currently, where Sam Darnold played football in high school. And he's obviously a local hero. He's a guy who's been revered for many years through his career at USC, obviously being, you know, a top five draft pick to the Jets, and throughout his many stops from, as you just mentioned, Carolina to San Francisco to the Vikings, obviously now found a home there in Seattle. And so it's been really fun as a guy who lives down there and has tracked Sam throughout his career in a community that's been, you know, pulling for him and obviously rallying around him right now as he gets ready to play in the biggest game of his career. It's been really fun to track him and watch him. And so I've caught balls for Sam Darnold as he's been training on the field before, so I know him a little bit. He's a great guy. And you ask any teammate that's played with him, there's not a better person in the NFL. And so I think there's a lot of guys around the league and around the football community that are certainly rooting for Sam.
And Brian, I have an even more fun story than Dennis. You know, he acts like he's all close to him in San Clemente, but I think it was 2 years ago, we were together at the Phoenix Open on 16. And obviously he wasn't in the playoffs or in the Super Bowl that year, but we were standing there and I had my boys with me and Sam and a few other guys when a hole-in-one was made on 16 and the whole place went pandemonium and we were just jumping around. We're hoping, I mean, like you said, we don't have a dog in this fight, but it'd be fun to see Sam kind of get that same excitement this week.
Right. Todd, what do you remember about the Super Bowl?
The Super Bowl, I never played in the Super Bowl. This is where Dennis always gets, you know, one over on me, because I was smack dab in the middle of the two Ravens Super Bowls. So I came in 2001 after the 2000 Super Bowl and then was with the Cardinals when they won the 2012-13 Super Bowl. So,
wow,
I was right in the middle of them, but, you know, I'm definitely pay attention this week. It's the biggest week in sports and love being a part of all the Super Bowl festivities.
And Dennis, looking back, I know that was one of Ray Lewis's last seasons, correct?
Yeah, it was Ray Lewis's last season when we won the Super Bowl in 2012 and obviously beat the hometown team here, the San Francisco 49ers. In the Harbaugh Bowl is what it was coined back then.
And, you lost power in the middle.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think most people remember that game for the lights going out just after halftime. And I think it was 45 minutes we sat on the field while they were trying to get the lights back on and figure out the situation. And so, needless to say, we had a 28-6 lead when the lights went off. And the momentum shifted a little bit after that. And we ended up narrowly escaping 34-31 in that game. But, I mean, we had our 10-year reunion just a couple seasons ago with that Super Bowl team. And, you know, it feels like yesterday that we just played in that game. But what a tremendous experience. I mean, you get an appreciation for how big the Super Bowl is this week when you're there in the host city and the media is everywhere. You have these big media sessions and you have everything from the Food Network asking you questions to, you know, any kind of a Spanish, you know, television. I know Spanish a little bit. I served a church mission in the Dominican Republic, so I had to do more interviews in Spanish than I can ever remember doing before during that week. So you get an appreciation for how big globally this game is, and it was an incredible experience.
And of course, the Ravens beat the Giants. That was pre 9/11. It was one of the last times it was sanity when it comes to security. I remember people having to walk in and out over in Tampa, and the Giants were just no match for the Ravens at that point. But that was before both you guys. Mike McDonald is coaching in this. He's the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, but he's got roots with John Harbaugh. And I want everyone to hear what Mike McDonald thinks of the new Giants coach. Cut 28.
I don't think it's possible to overstate his influence on me. I love John Harbaugh. He's one of my biggest mentors. Was willing to take chances on me when other people weren't, and invested in me and my career throughout, and stretched. You know, like the things that I felt like I could do. He had a vision for me in my career that I probably didn't have for myself, and all those principles that are part of his program that he's about as a person resonated with me, and those are a lot of the foundational principles that we brought to Seattle, and he's a great friend. He's got a great family, so I can't tell you how much I love him.
Hey, Todd, everybody needs a mentor, but it looks like that's who Mike McDonald calls a mentor. Tell me about the John Harbaugh you know.
You know, John Harbaugh, coming in as a coach, I had him his first 3 years as a coach. And it was a first-time deal for him. He was coming off of being a special teams coordinator in Philadelphia. And so, but you knew he had that kind of pedigree within himself. You know, they're a football family. And so he came in right away. And he just was so good at the details. He was so good at preparing us for situations, at showing us, you know, all the different situations you go through. And so we never saw a moment or a time in the NFL as a team, as an offense or a defense, that we weren't prepared for. And that was the biggest thing, is we were prepared with all the little details. I would say that was Coach Harbaugh, John's, his superpower. But and I'd also add, you know, as far as not having a dog in the fight, I think we're both partial to Mike McDonald. You know, being a Ravens guy, a defensive coordinator there for a handful of years, I'm definitely rooting for him in this matchup.
And Dennis, it must have been tough, too, because, you know, you couldn't really celebrate that much the win over your brother in the Super Bowl, you know, and Jim Harbaugh didn't take that loss well.
Yeah, I think we celebrated, you know, adequately, even though it was, you know, on the other side of the field, you had to have, you know, a brother dealing with, you know, losing that game. I'm sure that was always difficult. But listen, I didn't lose any sleep over it, I can tell you that.
I know that for sure. How do you think he's going to do with the Giants after 18 years? How do you think he's going to do?
I think he's going to do a really good job because, like Todd mentioned, he's incredibly organized. He sets a culture, and that's the biggest thing. I mean, a culture of accountability, a culture of hard work. You know, the Ravens' identity over the last 18 years has been tough, physical. It obviously starts with defense. That's always kind of what you think of when you think of the brand of the Ravens. And that's largely a culture that John Harbaugh set. And I think he's going to bring that same hardworking, tough, physical mentality to the Giants, which, in my opinion, is something that organization has lacked over the last handful of years that they've struggled. You go back to the Tom Coughlin days, I think that was their identity. And they've, you know, really departed from that over the last handful of seasons for whatever reason. So getting a guy like John Harbaugh to establish the culture, to kind of rein in everything, you know, that they've lacked over the last few years, I think is really important. I think he's going to do a great job.
I'm not sure how often you've, Todd Heap, you're wearing cleats, but you want other people to wear Caddx cleats. These are smart studs. Tell us about it.
So Caddx cleats, smart studs, it's a company that Dennis and I, and actually Joe Flacco now, have gotten involved in. But I have, you know, four boys that all wear cleats, and one in particular right now, my 14-year-old son that's wearing them on a daily basis. So it's a new cleat company, a new technology that prevents or it reduces that rotational force on your knees and ankles. And it's called smart studs because the studs can basically swivel and flex in all directions. And so you can check it out on Caddx.com, but we've had really great success for it. We had 40 guys in the NFL wearing them this year, and it's been impressive to see where we've gone just in the first year and a half of existence. But I think it's something that's going to change cleated sports going forward.
And Dennis, you're with the same organization. Do you have them on right now?
I'm not wearing them. I have one in my hand right now.
So what is the technology? Can you describe it?
Yeah, for sure. We'll do our best. We're a couple of dumb football players, but we'll dive into the science as best we can here. But yeah, unfortunately, I'm not wearing them. I'm sitting in a hotel room in San Fran with basically sharing a chair here. So we're nice and cozy.
I know. You guys do look close.
It's great. So like Todd mentioned, the cool thing about these cleats is the technology in the plate. And like you mentioned, it's smart stud technology. And so what that means is these studs on the bottom of your cleats, I don't know how well you guys can see this.
I can see it.
They can flex, they can spin, they can rotate in every direction. And what that provides is it really changes the dynamic between the athlete and the field condition or field surface. And so when I plant as an athlete, as a football player, as a soccer player, playing lacrosse, whatever that may be, I plant and change direction. There's a little bit of flexion, movement, the ability to kind of release from the turf a little bit easier. And so what that does is it relieves or eases that tension that goes up typically into the ankles and mm-hmm. to the knees. And it's able to reduce, like Todd mentioned, those rotational forces that are oftentimes the driver of non-contact ACL injuries, non-contact high ankle sprains, and all those kind of injuries that you hope could be prevented in some way, because football in particular is such an inherently dangerous sport. I mean, you can't prevent somebody coming crashing down on your knee that gets blocked into you or whatever else may happen on the field, or some of the vicious hits and tackles that we see. But just changing direction on the field shouldn't be something that you necessarily have to worry about. And so the cool thing about this technology is it's helping to mitigate some of those forces that oftentimes cause those injuries. And this is such a hot topic right now around sports in particular, but certainly in football, is field turf versus natural grass. And why players typically like natural grass over field turf is because there's a little bit more natural give when you change direction and plant. And so now with our cleats, you can recreate that give in a more firm, non-giving surface. And it's really a cool technology. Todd and I got involved with it because, number one, we thought to ourselves that if this actually works, this is remarkable. And we've both had injuries. My career ended with injuries. And so this is near and dear to our heart. We're, you know, our CEO and founder, Jack Rasmussen, you know, was watching a player on the field change direction and tear his ACL. And he thought there's got to be a better way to figure out how to mitigate that. You're not going to solve the injury problem. I mean, that's not realistic, but can we mitigate this in some way? You look around the landscape of the NFL right now, look how many guys, high profile players, are out with ACLs right now, from Micah Parsons to Patrick Mahomes to Nick Bosa. I mean, it's crazy the amount of ACL yeah. injuries right now, most of which are non-contact. It's a shame. And so a lot of people are pointing to the field conditions. You can't standardize field conditions. Certainly at the youth level, you can't. And so we're trying to do this, you know, on your feet. And so it's really a cool project that we've been involved in.
That's pretty awesome. So a couple of things. Number one, so they're Caddx cleats. I got to ask you, because just in terms of youth sports, people are listening to us right now, and we're talking to Todd Heap and Dennis Pitta from the they're both playing in the Ravens, tight ends. So for you, Todd, you've seen a lot of youth sports kids coming up right now. They say, they did a study, I think they said 17% of parents think their kids are going to go pro. When you're now back in it, your kids are now playing in it. How many pro athletes are you looking at in the various sports that you've seen and watched, knowing that you did get to that place?
At the youth level, how many have I seen? You don't see very many at the youth level. I mean, it's so hard to quantify at that level as well. I mean, the most important thing is that they learn, especially at a young age, just to have fun, just to play the game the right way, just to learn all the lessons that you can learn from competition and sports. I'm coaching a eighth grade football team right now, and we're padded and we're tackle, and it's a lot of fun. But who knows how many of those guys potentially have even the potential to go to the NFL. And so we try to teach them to do things the right way. We try to teach all of the lessons that they need to learn at that age to just grow into adults that can serve their community and be great in the community. And so that's the key. I mean, you know, you want them to grow up to be upstanding citizens. And as on top of that, you want them to have a great time playing sports and be healthy and safe and do it all safely.
Competing, but keeping in perspective. Dennis Pitta, Todd Heap, thanks so much, guys. Great to talk to you.
Thanks Brian. Man. Appreciate it.
You got it. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, that was so cool to be able to talk a little bit of football for a second, take an exhale. Just so you know, there's been a press conference about 90 minutes ago, maybe a little bit sooner than that. Tom Holman says we're taking down 700 agents are going to be leaving. Okay, leaving Minneapolis, but they do have access to the prisons. He complimented the mayor, the sheriff, he complimented the governor, and he just wanted to turn the page here. And I think that's great. I think turning down the temperature works. Blocking off blocks and deciding, running plates of FBI agents, Border Patrol agents, of ICE officials, not good. But meanwhile, we've got some good news. It just started 2 weeks ago, but we're already getting a ton of followers and great feedback. We have our own YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadShow. So you're going to have clips from this show, clips from me all over Fox News, like last night on The Five. I'll do special stuff just for the YouTube channel, behind-the-scenes stuff. You guys seem to really like it, so I'm more than happy to do some of that. Excited to have the new YouTube page, but go ahead. I know you're on YouTube already, but good, you put this address, youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadShow. And it's mostly radio. And we basically have turned this into a TV show with getting almost all our guests, like 80% of our guests are on Zoom too. So you're really seeing audio and video as an option. And soon we'll be revamping the studio and make it even more TV friendly. Remember, when we started, this was just a radio show, but now we're so much more. We're glad you listen to however you do it. Brian Kilmeade.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. This hour, one great guest, Karl Rove, standing by, and we'll be getting to him shortly. We do know we made some news right away when Tom Holman opened up this morning with a press conference saying things are going a lot better now. Things are settling down. They're not perfect. I'm not leaving, but I am going from 3,000 agents. I'm going to take out 700. So that's significant, he said to the mayor and to the governor. Local police, you guys work with me here when I got here last week. We'll draw down. We'll bring down the temperature. And he's done all that. So before we get to Karl, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They had a chance to do something a while ago and it didn't work out. And we did Midnight Hammer. I don't think they want that happening again, but they would like to negotiate. We are negotiating with them right now, yes.
Yes, here we go. Breaking point. U.S. attacked twice by Iran in different ways. One by a drone. The other, they tried to take one of our merchant ships. It didn't work out for Iran. But they are trying to talk to us only about nuclear weapons. Really? Are we really going to follow through with this? I don't think so. Mr. President, finish the job.
Number two.
So take a look here. Favor voter ID to vote. You'll notice on all of it, it's all north of 75%. A photo ID to vote is not controversial in this country. It is not controversial by party, and it is not controversial by race.
And what's controversial is they're saying that on CNN. Voter ID, stunningly, both sides agree. America wants it. All genders, all ethnicities. So why is Chuck Schumer calling it racist?
Number one.
The attacks on American citizens by masked hoodlums. If you were attacked by a masked person, you might think you were being kidnapped. You'd be justified in shooting the person.
Really? Thank you, Jerry Nadler. For Jerry Nadler making everything worse, as usual. The government funded for 2 weeks, for at least two more weeks, as DHS now in the crosshairs of Democrats who want to see some reforms, and others want to see it abolished. We're in the middle of a woke two attempt to bring back the woke culture. The good news is all those woke people who are into that woke stuff are not spreading it. It's not running through corporate America. It's not running through the sports world. No one's going to be taking a knee over the weekend. I think we are pretty much done with it. Let's bring in Karl Rove as he joins us. He is Fox News contributor, Washington Wall Street Journal columnist. Karl, welcome back. Were you surprised at Howard Enten doing the polls? Over 70% of the country want to see voter ID. How do we get it across the finish line?
Yeah, well, first of all, this is not new. Go back over, you know, the polling for this for years has been, you know, it's common sense. I mean, how many of us get to write a check without showing an ID?
Nobody.
How many of us get to board an airplane without doing an ID? How many of us, when we go to pick something up at the, you know, UPS store, don't have to show ID? I mean, it's look, it's common sense. But the Democrats, for some reason or another, are just stuck on this because they think that it is either the damaging to people of color, which is not shown in the polls. They don't think so. Or they want to keep it alive to keep the left of their party energized by saying that it is an attempt to depress voter turnout among people of color.
This is what they say about the SAVE Act. Listen to Senator Chuck Schumer, cut 13.
The Senate did its job to fund 96% of the government while splitting the DHS bill from the rest of the funding package so we can rein in ICE and end the violence. Now it's the House's turn to do its job. But a band of MAGA radicals want to hijack government funding to push an outlandishly toxic bill called the SAVE Act that would disenfranchise millions of American citizens.
I don't know what he's referring to. Are you a supporter of the SAVE Act?
I have a concern, which is the Constitution leaves the manner of the elections to the states. And I'm reluctant to say that the federal government ought to step in and tell the states what to do in running their elections, because just as, I mean, look, I'm all in favor of voter ID. We have it here in Texas. You know, we have strong turnout in Texas. But what I worry about is a Democrat Congress and a Democratic president using that principle. We can dictate to the states to do what we want them to do, to say things like every state must have, you know, universal mail-in ballots, and the universal mail-in ballots must be accepted up to, you know, 3 days after, if postmarked by the election day, accepted up to 3 days, and so on and so forth. Automatic registration of everybody at the age of 18. I'm not in favor of the federal government dictating what ought to be a state and local responsibility under our Constitution.
Interesting, Carl, because how are you ever going to have something as cut, which I think is commonsensical, as voter ID if you don't mandate it from the federal government? Because, you know, you have things like, yeah. What is it, is it Montana or is it Washington State where everybody mails in a ballot?
Washington State. But that's the point. Look, if we establish the principle that the constitutional requirement of the states being in charge of setting the manner and nature of the elections is violated, then liberals, when they get control, can do it to us. And it's like I have misgivings about, for example, Hillary and Bill Clinton being forced to testify by Congress, saying if you don't show up and testify, we're going to hold the former president in contempt. Well, what happens when Donald Trump is no longer in office? If there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress and they say, we want Donald Trump and Melania to show up and testify, and we're going to hold them in contempt. And if they don't show up, we're going to refer them to the Department of Justice for criminal prosecution. I mean, we got to be a little bit careful in the standards and that we set in this. And I would rather have the battle, for example, on voter ID by getting an amendment campaign in California that says we want to have voter ID in California. And then to say the federal government, the federal Congress is now in charge of determining the manner and nature of the elections.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. You think down the line, think about the ripple effect of what'll happen. But I'll tell you, with the Bill and Hillary Clinton thing is fascinating, because the whole Epstein Files thing. I mean, everybody is implicated. I mean, for example, RFK says, you know, I flew with my daughter into, I think, Utah to do an environmental thing on Epstein's plane. He did normal stuff. I mean, he flew and did some things. It's charitable organization, anti-AIDS action. People did it. But if they're named on that list, they're tarred forever. Bill Gates is one situation, which we knew that was coming. Yeah. Prince Andrew, we knew that was coming. But there are other people caught up in that. And now we have Bill Clinton, who was all over this plane, you know, all over this story. Yeah. And you heard Trump yesterday. He's like, I was telling you that innocent people are going to get caught up in this. A lot of names and lives are going to be ruined. And that's how it's playing out.
Yeah. And I think that was in direct response to the fact that the former president and first lady are going to be called, because, I mean, it establishes the precedent. A congressional committee can call a former president. And if the former president asserts for privilege, they can override that and threaten him with criminal prosecution if he doesn't show up. I'm with you, though. I mean, God. All of these people hung around this guy. What a sleazy guy. And I mean, you have people on the left and you have people on the right. I mean, Steve Bannon is hanging around this guy. He's going to do he's advising him. He's giving him
a documentary on him.
Counsel. You're going to do a documentary on him to, you know, sort of freshen his reputation. Really bizarre.
So we'll see what happens. There are no winners, absolutely no winners in the whole thing. And they wanted another 2 million plus pages out. I've never seen more pages on anyone. But we'll see where that goes and if it's going to play a role in the midterm elections. I'm just curious, as we get set for the midterms, But the majority of Republicans are still for the president enforcing immigration laws. Only 22% think he hasn't gone far enough. 45% says he just got it just about right. What would you like to see emerge out of Minneapolis after Tom Homan's press conference today? He seems to have settled things down for now and taken out 700 agents. If I was to put you in charge of going forward from here, what would you do?
Well, there are two different questions involved there. Let's first of all get the politics out of the way right away. It's not just how Republicans view this. It's about how swing voters view this. This election cannot be won alone by either the Democrats getting out a majority, you know, getting out the vast majority of Democrats to vote, or Republicans doing the same. It's by generating maximum turnout among your base and winning the swing voters, winning the you know, the majority of people who identify with neither party. Now, that's a small group of people, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15%, depending on the state. So, but the politics of this is we can't just look at this, if you're interested in the political implications, by looking at the Republicans and Democrats alone. You have to look at the independents. But as to the substance, I think Homan has got it right. The purpose of this was to identify violent illegals who were in our society, who had committed acts that brought them into contact with our justice system and had either served their time or are serving their time or had somehow escaped justice, and getting them out of the country. And there is an enormous wave of support for that. Beyond that is more problematic, because we all know somebody who either is or knows somebody who has come to this country illegally, but then since then has kept their nose clean and is, you know, working on a construction crew or, you know, cleaning houses or working in a hospital or waiting tables or working in a meatpacking plant or serving in agriculture. And, you know, we need to find a way to deal with those people that doesn't involve, you know, sort of sending squads out on the streets of America to try and rout them out.
So, so they say that a couple of things Republicans, Democrats are asking for in terms of reform: get the masks off, put your names on the jerseys. Number two is get a judicial warrant if you're going to be hunting down any target, which is going to be impossible. There's no way anyone will agree to that. And the body cameras, I think they've all virtually agreed to. So these are some of the changes that they want. To get the government funded, they're going to have to give somewhere. How does DHS get funded?
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on how many Democrats want to dig in their heels. Look, I understand the thing about masks, but on the other hand, I worry about officers being doxxed and their families being identified. I'm all in favor of, you know, you don't need to have their name. You can have an identifier, a unique identifying number that says that's key to who they are. And yes, they definitely ought to have body cameras. In fact, they welcome them. What we learned from the experience with body cameras with police was that it virtually in all instances helped the police show that they were doing things by the book in the appropriate way. The question of a warrant for everybody is problematic. I think it's just an attempt to game up the system, clog it up. So, the Democrats are going to have a problem for themselves if they dig in their heels too much on this, because at some point people are going to say, this is sort of like defund the police. You're really trying to get rid of them, and you're really trying to put these officers in jeopardy and their families. So no, you know, stop it, Democrats. And if they were smart, they'd take what they could get. Homan's a reasonable guy. He can come to an agreement with them on certain things. I mean, think about it. They already gave up on the question of the cameras. Homan said, well, we're not arguing about that. We want them. We're going to get cameras immediately for everybody in Minneapolis, and we're going to put a big order in for cameras for everybody.
Yeah, I want you to hear what Congresswoman Jayapal is calling for, cut six.
I mean, the whole DHS is a creation post 9/11 that should not exist. It is way too unwieldy. It's all these agencies put together. They should not be there. Right now, they're detaining 76,000 people every night in detention centers. And 95% of them have zero criminal record. So this is something I honestly never thought I would see in the United States of America.
So, number one, that stat is not right. 90%.
No, not right. Yeah. Not right at all. And look, a lot of the people that are being detained are people who are coming across the border illegally, whom we caught at the border and are waiting to process out of the country. And look, I would say to this congresswoman, we have not been hit again since 9/11. And part of the reason is why is we took the fight to the enemy abroad, and the Department of Homeland Security was stood up and kept us safe. And, you know, to now whimsically say, oh, we don't need them. What world does she think we're living in? I guess her fundamental problem is she wants open borders. She wants people to be able to come and go as they see fit. She's not apparently concerned about the security of the homeland.
I want to talk about what's happening in Iran right now. I think the president, to go through the motions and have nuclear talks only with Iran, after they sent a drone heading for our aircraft carrier and tried to take our merchant ship while threatening the lives still of Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, and the President of the United States? Is this a head fake that we're talking to him, Carl?
Well, we shouldn't be talking to him if all we're going to do is talk about the things they want to talk about rather than the things the world wants us to talk with them about. Look, it's not just what you said. Think about it. This is the principal underwriter of Hezbollah, Hamas, you know, the Houthis. These people are attempting to bring down the West by violence and by disruption and chaos. And if we're going to sit there and say we're going to ignore 90% of the problem that you represent, and we'll talk about nuclear weapons, but oh, we can't talk about the fact you're trying to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles that can attack us, is nuts. So I'm look, the president showed his true mettle with sending B-2 bombers over to blow the hell out of their nuclear facilities. I'm reasonably confident he's smart enough to not fall for this, which is we only want to talk about the things that we're incapable of providing right now, namely nuclear weapons. But we want to work it out with you so we can continue to develop them. We'll give up the highly enriched uranium that we've got because, well, frankly, you know, we want you to get off our back, but not deal with the other issues and let them continue. They're a rich country that's taking its wealth and spending it on terrorism and violence and chaos around the world, not on the best interest and the best desires of their people.
Yeah, no water. They have no water. They have no economy. Yeah, they got a valueless currency.
Infrastructure.
Yeah.
Talk about. Yeah. I mean, literally, you cannot buy an Iranian real on the international market because it has a value of zero.
Yes.
Zero. It only has value inside the country because if you don't accept the real, well, you know, the government may do something to you.
Right. Carl, you know what? The president should finish the job here. This has been brewing since 1979. Carl Rove, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Always great.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
You got
great
it.
To see you.
Hey, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want, truth you demand. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Yeah, welcome back. Went a little long with Carl, but I can go on for him forever because what I like most, I think this is what you need most these days. You don't need people cheerleading for every Democratic cause or every Republican cause. You need people to analyze, and you need it based on the numbers. I could always tell there's so many Republicans out there that just, and there's less, that everything they do, everything Donald Trump does is wrong. Yeah, I can't believe he ever said that. I can't believe he ever did that. And there's other people that if Donald Trump wouldn't have been their choice, but they look at what he's doing and they say, probably sign off on 80% of it. But I think the value of a Karl Rove, especially, is that he'll call out the 20%. And it doesn't mean he's right or Trump's right or wrong and wrong. It says, and my analysis says this, you could lose, you know, Texas is in trouble. You know, my analysis is that you're losing independence. You got Republicans, but you're losing independence with the aggressive ICE activities, even if you think it's right. And that's why I think it's valuable to have analysts. Like, well, I think on the left, I think Axelrod. Axelrod came out last week after everyone was praising Newsom and his new biography. He's humble and he's smart and he's endlessly handsome. But he says you're inauthentic. Are you the guy in the podcast? Or are you the guy tweeting against Trump? Which one are you? She's got to be real. So listen, when we come back, I really am going to take your calls. 1-866-408-7669.
His mouth to your ears. It's Brian Kilmeade.
And we should have voter ID, by the way. We should have a lot of the things that I think everybody wants to see. Who would not want voter ID? Only somebody that wants to cheat. Think of it. We don't have voter ID. And the Democrats don't want it. And the reason they don't want it is because they want to cheat.
Well, that's what I assume. Well, put it this way. If you legitimately thought you're going to knock minorities out of the voting rolls. No, cleaning up the voting rolls. If I thought for a second the Republicans were looking to knock out minorities off voter rolls, I'd be the first one saying something about it. And I think most everybody would. Most everyone. Number one, you cannot win a district just because with one ethnicity, period. So if you think you're getting away with something in the short term, go ahead. Good luck with that. You know, you redistrict for a reason. I got that. Gerrymandering, we can debate it. That's not what I'm talking about. Preventing people from voting is not something I don't know anybody. I'm talking about closed circles. I'm talking about small circles, big circles, speeches. Nobody has said the way to win an election is to make sure nobody shows up. The less, the better. Turnout might work out in certain states for certain parties, but that's not what anyone's approaching. I just want to find out who really won every election. School board, president of the United States. That's all. I want to find out. I just want to know the final score is the final score. Now, think about it. In sports, when you see someone make a catch and you watch the replay and it's a catch and it turns out the ref on the field, an instant replay doesn't overturn it and the ref got it wrong, you say to yourself, that team got robbed. But you have to deal with the result. All they're trying to say, what the Republicans are trying to say is, there's a chance that people are going to cheat, but let's diminish that chance to the most possible, best possible way. And the version of sports instant replay, which is now in tennis and now baseball, there's not a major sport with that instant replay, is to make sure the people that show up are the people that are supposed to. It doesn't mean that some people aren't still going to cheat. I imagine some people aren't going to get the message. First generation Americans might be confused. I want to make sure if people get married or divorced and their names changes, they don't get stopped. There's got to be things built in for that. Hey, I got divorced in October. There's an election in November. I showed up to vote and they wouldn't accept my new name. We got to make sure that doesn't happen because 50% of all marriages don't work out. That means there'll be a huge percentage of people who go to get married and then can't vote, which will be a travesty. But to me, that's so easily fixable. So if you told me, for example, I can't get on a plane if my passport doesn't match my license, I'm going to make sure that I do what's necessary to make sure American or Delta or JetBlue get me on that plane so people can be a little bit resourceful in life. Kevin in Missouri. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind with all this controversy in Minnesota? If people are just tuning in, we are drawing down in Minneapolis to a degree because they stayed over cooperation. We'll see now if the local officials will push back on Tom Holman and say we're not cooperating, but it was a pretty encouraging press conference.
I'm worried that we're setting a precedence here. All of a sudden, the last couple of days, I feel like these zealots have a good foothold, and they're not going to stop with Minnesota. I'm a 70-year-old man. I don't know how much longer I have to live, but I am so afraid. I am afraid that we're going to lose the vote. If you just have a poor voting system, it's just going to be, we might as well be in China or Russia or someplace else or a third world country. It scares the hell out of me, in plain words.
Yeah, look, but there are certain things, and you might not agree, and that's fine, Kevin, but there are certain things I think were done ham-handedly. You know, and I know, you know, guys like Charlie Kirk, I imagine Stephen Miller, Bannon, a lot of people on the right. We're not, they said everyone out. If you came here illegal, you're out. I'm more practical than that. I don't think everyone out is the way to go. As soon as you seal the border, I want to talk to you about getting the immigration system fixed. But until you seal the border, I couldn't talk to you because you'll just backfill whatever gets restricted. But I do think chasing down people who have been here 12 years and have not been a problem, a part of society, their kids are in school, shouldn't be something. And when we work our way down the list, we shouldn't have gotten in 4 years, a couple of years. Then we work out something where they never get citizenship, never reward illegal behavior, but maybe extended work visas with a sponsor. And then you make it easier for people who are getting married, American citizen, make it easy for them to get here. Maybe don't bankrupt them with all these fees. Maybe make it easier for first round draft picks to stay here. You know, we train them, we educate them, and then we send them back to their country. I wouldn't mind keeping the first round draft picks here. You know, a lot of people are against that. And these are debates I think are worth having. Criminals got to go. But somehow that line got blurred and the communication's been terrible and people are allowed to spin this thing. So I do think that if we could focus on the criminals, make it clear what you're doing, and then work our way down to people overstayed visas, and then you continue to work your way down on that list. By the time people, by the way, 2 million people left on their own. So these people are, as Mitt Romney said, self-deporting. But when you tell them they have a sanctuary city to stay and no one can touch them, they're not going to self-support. But I do know that some major powers like China, like Russia, are wilting. France, Europe. Their population's diminishing. People are having less kids and they're not being replaced with other kids. So they're coming in from other places, or they're just, society is dying. 1-866-408-7669. So we do need people. Joe in Florida. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Brian. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm in as Hannity likes to say, the free state of Florida. And our governor, who I think is one of the best governors in the country, if not of all time, is Ron DeSantis, as you know.
I know.
So his term is up this year. I know him and Trump had some difficulties. I don't know.
They get along great now. Joe, I don't know if you saw the story over the weekend. Trump was asked about DeSantis. He goes, "We'll always be friends." He said some really encouraging things about him.
Well, that's good to hear. What do you think his future holds for him now, well, once he leaves the governorship?
Put it this way, I'm not saying that I know, but I'm just saying that it's natural. Every administration at the midterm, you know, Trump had a ton of it the first time, rotates people around or out. Like Dan Bongino had to leave. You know, he's losing millions of dollars, and he wanted to go. He could leave personal things. He had to get back to his family. He's got a young daughter. There's circumstances like that. I mean, I think that he'd be great at DHS. I think he'd be great a lot of different places. You know, maybe Kristi Noem would do better in different places. I don't think she's been extraordinary. I don't love the way she approached her other things. You know, I don't think she had a few really good interviews, but most of the time she goes on these contentious interviews, and I don't really necessarily think she's too strong, where DeSantis is off the charts great. This is where you need, but DeSantis, I think, is going to be awesome. It's too bad you can't do what you do in New York and just run for that job again. But his wife would be great. I think Byron Donalds has a chance to be great. I think he's got this finance background. He knows understands the federal government, how to work with states. I think he could be really good. Eric in Arizona. Hey, Eric.
Good morning, sir. Real quick, I think communication is a big problem. We're outnumbered with the media. The midterm convention, I think, is a very good way to make all the media listen and to get out the word to the people who normally don't listen. So I think that's a big deal, and hopefully we can get it done.
I think the midterms have yet to be played. To me, this is my analogy. Are you a sports fan?
Yes, I am.
Did you ever, like growing up, get the preseason guides like Street and Smith?
Oh, yeah, I grew up in Texas. We got them all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you're sure when you read these columns, they'll tell you exactly. Cowboys are coming in first. The Giants are coming in last. Expect the Chargers to be impossible to stop. And then the season starts, and they end up totally backwards in about 70% of the cases. So when people say the Republicans are in trouble, I'm like, yeah, what's the date? It's February. If your polls are right and the generic ballot, it does lean 6 points to Democrats and it's high, okay. But it's February. So much can change. Did anyone think Maduro was going to get pushed out? I think we're definitely coming to a conflict over in Iran. Does anyone know exactly where the economy is going to be Is the housing, are we going to drop rates to the point where housing gets unstuck? You know, are people going to start understanding what the Trump accounts are doing to a whole generation of Americans and how forward-leaning this is? Are they going to feel that the tax return like the president thinks they're going to feel? So all this stuff has to happen. Are things going to continue to be, are things going to smooth out in these inner cities? Is crime going to continue to drop? So all these things have to play. So people will say, well, the Republicans are in trouble. Democrats have it eat. Okay. It's February. If the election was today, you might be right. But you cannot tell me what the spring's going to be like, what the summer's going to be like, and then what the message is going to be from October on. And we'll see what happens.
Well, I think that's really the point of the midterm convention, is they'll be able to really tell that story in a way where the media, all of them, are sitting there, the people are going to listen. There's always a bump. And the only way for them to know about it is to be told. That, to me, hopefully is one way to do it.
Yeah, and they do have to have, you know, I think it's great they did the economic plan, the big beautiful bill, so-called big beautiful bill. They did it all at once. And people go, well, that's all you passed. Well, to tell you the truth, it's a big Frankenstein. It's a Frankenstein in a good way. And it's everything's in there. But they got to do something else. There's got to be something else they can do. And maybe it's the Voting Act. You know, maybe there's other things that they could put out there. They got to get something else done as they have these slim majorities. And they got a message out there and actually contrast it. This is what I'd like to see. I would love to see Democrats asked, okay, affordability is key. Good word. What are you going to do about it? I'm going to raise taxes on the rich. Well, they're already paying. The top 10% pay 70% of all the taxes. Do you want to pay 100%? So what do you want to do on Social Security? Okay, well, you want to raise the threshold on Social Security. Well, that's an issue. That's where you stand. That's fine. On health care, okay, you wanted all the subsidies continuing. Okay, it's not going to happen. How are you going to fix Obamacare? Is it working for you? Because the hospitals don't think it's working. The people don't think it's working. It's got to continue to be financed. Make Democrats answer the questions. And I think Ezra Klein did a podcast just saying that the Democrats, all they're doing is complaining and whining and ridiculing and canceling. And Ezra Klein is a liberal podcaster who writes for the New York Times. That's what you need. I would love to see people innovate, and Republicans will be caught on their heels. I could tell you exactly what Republicans want to do at the border, exactly what they want to do on taxes, exactly what they want to do when it comes to voting, exactly what they do when it comes to defense. I could tell you what most want to do when it comes to cutting programs. All I know is the Democrats that speak just talk about how rich people are getting away with things, most of which are Democratic donors until recently. And how they want to tax more. I just don't know what pro-growth policies they have. I mean, does it bother Democrats that they seem to be anti-American? Does it bother Democrats that they don't want to celebrate? Most of them don't want to celebrate 250 years of the country. Does it bother Democrats that most of the people don't, most Democrats don't want to support Israel, support the anti-Semitism, the pro-Hamas marches? And the way I know they support it is because they don't speak out against it, except for people like Joe Manchin and John Fetterman. Does that bother them? Because if it does, I'd love to see a pro-American politician, man or woman, emerge that's done things in life and had success in business, ran for office, did a good job, and now wants to run for higher office. That has that mix of attributes that come to the table that's not going to be running anti-Trump. I would love to see that. I've not seen that. The guy that is leading right now, all he does is tweet about Trump and consider him to do opposite of what Trump wants. And I'm talking about Gavin Newsom. Kamala Harris, I think, has no shot. I don't care where she polls or how unique her background is. And I'm not talking about her resume. I'm talking about her ethnicity. She always points to that. James, listen to KCRS in Odessa. Hey, James.
Hey, Brian. I'm afraid that a big gap that we're missing on the getting out the message part is someone filling in for Charlie Kirk. I don't think that getting the message out, and this isn't personally towards you or anyone, but your audience, Clay and Buck's audience, Sean audience, isn't the problem. It's getting the message out to those people who don't watch conservative TV or watch conservative radio or actually just watch political TV or watch political radio. That's a huge audience that I think Charlie Kirk tapped into. And if they don't get that voice going again somehow, that's what worries me more than just saying we got to get the word
well,
out.
Well, it's a good point. But, James, I will say that 35 to 40% of the Fox audience is Democrats and independents. So that's pretty impressive, I think. And I think I got a similar radio show here, just judging by what my affiliates tell me. We don't put the money into the demographics on radio side as much as TV. But I think you'll find a diverse audience. And the thing is, CNN and MSNBC are so much below us that it's not like, well, we have the same ratings. That one's Democrats, one's Republican. I think there's a huge blend on Fox. I think we have a lot of viewers that understand we're pro-America and less pro-Republican, but you can be the judge there. But I do think that the group, the Turning Point group, is bigger than ever. But it's hard to imagine another personality being as big as Charlie. But I think you have to drill down a little bit and see the work they're doing locally. That if it was just Charlie, it wouldn't have been effective. The thing about that organization, it started like just Charlie with five people, and now it's so spread out. They're doing the fundamentals, and I think they're going to get a lot of money from Donald Trump super PAC and the Republican super PAC. They have outraised Democrats considerably. Good point, guys. Back in a moment.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
When I came up, I worked 18 hours a day. That's very unhealthy and it was very unproductive. And what I've done with myself now, I work harder than I ever have these days on all the things that I'm doing, but I've gone into a different metric. I want to be productive. So 7 hours, 20 minutes of sleep. My diet's completely changed. I exercise every day for an hour and a half. I'm completely focused on productivity. I don't make major decisions worth over $1 million after 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I never do that. My staff knows I start at 5:30. I want to be sharp when I take huge bets. And I'm telling my entrepreneurs now, if you're the kind of person, men and women, that, you know, I've learned from my mistake, I don't want you working that way. I want you sharp, healthy, focused on longevity, watching what you eat. How much do you sleep? That's the new me. And I'm telling all my entrepreneurs, if you're not that way, I don't invest in you.
So I have something to say about that. Did he get to where he is by working 16 hours early? Now that he's a multimillionaire worth, you know, let's say $1 billion, just to pick a round number, worth $1 billion. I don't know if he is worth $1 billion. This is what I would ask him, and we'll get him on. Is he worth $1 billion if he worked out 90 minutes a day, didn't make big decisions after 1 p.m.? 5:30 is great. I mean, that's easy for us. We're always up early. But it's hard to imagine because you got to network. Do you consider work? I got to go out to. I got to go meet three other business people. I got to be able to go into a big firm. They might need me to work a little bit later. Maybe work on a Saturday. Go to a convention. I don't know. I watched one of the guys. This guy Alex Karp of Palantir has a different philosophy, 180 degrees.